Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper. And remember, I'm only as hip as my guests. And I have a great guest today. He's a very funny guy. He's been around for a long time. And this is a very odd coincidence, Greg. His name's Greg Fitzsimmons. How you doing, Greg?
It's a pleasure, Steve.
Very odd coincidence. When I first moved to L.A., I was waiting tables at Planet Hollywood in Beverly Hills. And the one waitress was your co-host on a show called Idiot Savants. Was it on MTV?
I remember that that's where she went. It was right after the show
Shonda
ended. What's that?
Her name is Shonda Farr.
Yes.
Yeah, it's funny because they knew I used to do stand-up, and I've been out of stand-up. And I was screwing around a little bit here and there, and I wasn't really doing it that much, and I was trying to get writing going. But I remember she said she hosted a show. And you always wonder, it's just weird when you see someone who's on TV, then you're waiting tables with them.
Yeah.
Then when I was new to the – as comics, you know how it is. We were getting paid. I mean, once you start going on the road, you get paid. But you always thought if someone got on TV – that was it.
You're made. You're in a mansion in Beverly Hills.
Yeah. And it was always cracking me. I'm like, wait, she's waiting tables?
Yeah.
So I thought of you when I got you on the show.
She was cute. Oh, boy.
Sweetheart, too.
Yeah, real sweet.
She was quarterback Bubby Brister's niece, who used to play for the Eagles and the Steelers.
Wow, that's a piece of trivia.
That's me. I'm full of useless trivia. So, okay, let's get started here. You started comedy in Boston, right?
Yes.
But now you're from New York.
Yes.
Now, did you go to school up in Boston?
Yeah, I went to Boston University. So I was going to class during the day, and then I'd wait online on Sunday nights and Monday nights to get on at these open mic nights and, eventually started working.
Now, what made you want to get into comedy? A lot of times I'd guests come on, and like for me, I said, you'd see like the Carson, and then, or for me, like I would see Woody Allen movies. A lot of comics say they would see certain comics on TV. Did you know at a young age you wanted to do comedy, or were you like a tough kid, or what was your gig?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of a tough kid because I had to be. I was very small, and I think I was very intimidated by other people. So to this day, I think I go out of my way to try to be tougher than I really am because of my size and all that. And I think stand up really was an offshoot of that. I think it was a way for me to level the playing field a little bit with bigger guys and to be able to, can I curse?
Just no F-bombs.
Okay, shit on them and just get people to see that they couldn't hurt me and that I could actually hurt them worse.
Okay.
And so I think I came out of that. My stand-up is very sardonic and cutting and sarcastic, and I think that that's probably a part of it. And also my father was a big radio guy in New York my whole life.
Okay.
And he used to host the Jerry Lewis Telethon for 20 years.
Okay.
He hosted a lot of he'd MC any charity event or whatever. And he really did stand up. He was a radio guy, but he loved to go out and put his tuxedo on, and basically he had his little routines.
See, isn't
and
that
I'd
funny?
Go watch him. Yeah.
That's so cool.
So he was like, if you talk about what comedian influenced me in terms of like, I saw you could do it.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's because a lot of times people say, comics, I don't know how old you are, but I think any comics over 35 and up, they all sit there and they go, you really didn't have a clue how to do it, but
yeah.
See, for you, it was right in front of you. So, did your dad encourage you going to stand up? Or
yeah, but he also encouraged me to write as well. He said, stand up is great, but you'll always be able to make a living as a writer. And it's funny that he said that because I followed that advice, and there's never, like right now, I'm doing stand. I was just on the road for 3 weekends straight, but I'm also writing on a show. I'm doing Punch Up on a show, which means I go in maybe once a week, and then I write from stuff they email me a couple other days a week.
Okay.
And I've written on dozens of shows over the last 12 years.
Now, did you go to school for writing? Was it writing at Boston?
Yeah. I was an English major.
Okay.
And, and I did think I'd be a writer of some sort. I didn't know that I'd be a stand-up comic until, I didn't even know that I would do it for a living for the first 2 or 3 years I was doing it. To me, it was just, I couldn't believe they were going to let me go on stage.
Now, you were in college at the time?
Yeah.
Okay, so that must have been cool, too, because it's like, it makes you a little different than the other students. I mean, I went to a small school in New Jersey. We're in the middle of nowhere, and I used to do, I get up and tell a joke or two at, the campus pub.
Yeah.
And I was, big crap. But it must have been cool that you're actually, was there other guys you went to school with doing it, or were you, the one that went to Boston?
Yeah, no, John Henson and I were at BU, Jeffrey Ross, Mark Maron.
Okay, so all of them.
And then Elon Gold. And so, but really it was more the local scene. And the local scene was I started really with Joe Rogan.
Okay.
And Chris McGuire, Tom Cotter. And so I think it was kind of cool because I didn't have that graduate. I never put a resume together. I just was going at stand-up.
Okay.
I was, you know, working as a waiter, but less and less as I was making more and more money as a stand-up. And I was able to pretty much make a living not long after graduating college because I'd been doing it already for a while.
Were you doing it most all the Boston clubs? Or cause I know a lot of
New England, all over New England.
Okay, because I remember the few New England gigs I did a guy named John Schuler. He had The Last Laugh in Hartford, Connecticut.
Okay, yeah, I remember that.
Awful one-nighters. One's like in Canaan, New York, and you walk in, it's like a converted barn.
Yeah.
And you're going, holy crap.
Yeah, back then, there was comedy was so hot, and New England seemed to be hotter than any place in the country. So
every place, I heard New England was off the hook.
I mean, yeah, New Hampshire, Maine, Rhode Island, you know, anywhere you could go in Massachusetts where there was a Chinese restaurant, there was a back room with a microphone in it.
Yeah, and you got paid. That's cool.
And you got paid. If you had a car and you could drive and you could do 15 minutes, you could make $500 cash a week.
Right, right.
You know, and be doing what you loved. And a lot of times part of the gig was you had to pick up the headliner and drive him because he'd lost his license drunk driving. And so that was really the key. You had to have a functioning car.
I know.
And be good with directions, more so than being a good comedian.
I'd be like when the booker would call you and they'd be like, okay, can you pick him up at the Philadelphia 30th Street station? Or wait, if not there, like the speed line on 8th and Market. I'm like,
yeah.
I don't know who they go. He'll be a guy. He's African-American. He's got dreads. And I'm like, and you're driving. You're going, okay, I hope I pick the right African-American guy.
Yeah, right.
But I had the same thing. I was in a workable car. And there was like, well, I used to always take Keith Robinson, a guy from, I used to always take him to gigs. And it was great because you were new, and back then you did get paid.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you're in Boston, you're working the road, working that area. Now, were you doing any freelance writing at that time or?
A little bit. There was a radio guy named Mark Parento, and I wrote some stuff for him. And then it wasn't until I came to New York years later that I had worked with Norm MacDonald, okay, opening for him. And he liked me, so he said, yeah, he said, why don't you fax into the show for a weekend update there? So he was with his producer, and she gave me the fax number. And me and my buddy Mike Gibbons started faxing. We would stay up all night.
Remember that? I used to fax to the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
It was such a different time then. People are so spoiled now. It's like,
I know.
Back then, it's like, you'd fax, and then you had to pay the phone. Of course, you had to pay the phone call for it, and it's out of the area, so you're going, Jesus Christ. But you would sit there, and you had to type it, and it's just so different now. But so you were faxing.
We stay up all night, me and my buddy writing jokes, eating Chinese food, and we just couldn't believe the honor that we had. We had a fax number for SNL. I mean, it made me float on air, and we did it for 6 months. We would just fax in jokes to SNL.
Anything get picked up?
We would sit by the TV on Saturday night, our hearts racing, Weekend Update would come on, and never anything. We couldn't believe it because we knew that there were some that were good jokes, and there were some that were getting on that were real similar. So years later, my friend Mike Gibbons, the guy I did it with, he has become since like he's like one of the biggest showrunners in TV for late night TV, and so he created Norm's last show with him, the sports show on Comedy Central. So he'd never met him, and so they start working together, and he waits, and a week or two in, he goes, by the way, we faxed jokes in for a long time to SNL, and Norm is like, I don't think so there, because he's like got OCD and he remembers everything, and he used to read every fax that came in back then. And then Lori Jo, who was his producer, said, no, there's no way. If you were faxing in, you would have gotten a confirmation from us. We had the wrong fax number.
Oh, man. Oh, God, but at least, you know, I mean, that sucks, but at least you got to feel that excitement.
That's
It's like, at least you got, I mean, in retrospect, you're like, oh, crap, but you've done well for yourself, so it's cool, but it's still, you just got that feeling. A lot of people don't get that feeling. I mean, just, and I know what you're talking about when you're sitting there and you're watching, like, I would fax stuff into Letterman, but, or like an email, he had this email thing, which was a scam, it was when AOL was big, but you would sit there and you'd wait to see, and you know, Letterman doesn't take outside submissions, but you would still, it's just that feeling when you sit there and you would wait and it'd be all excited. So that was your stab at writing. No, at least you didn't know then. Now, she would probably been a little frustrated.
I was frustrated, but again, the overriding pride that I was even had one degree of separation from Saturday Night Live made up for it, you know. And you know, that the jokes I wrote ended up being, you know, the jokes I showed to get other writing jobs later. You know, you pick the ones that are kind of evergreen that weren't topical, but they were just funny.
Right.
About I remember one was that there were some Jehovah's Witnesses going door to door, and there was a lightning storm in Texas, and they were struck by lightning and they died. Afterwards, there were no witnesses.
Okay.
And I remember, like, that was one of those ones that it wasn't a news story anybody really right. heard. So I had dozens of jokes like that that I put together in a packet, and they helped me get jobs writing on other shows.
Now, at what point did you decide you said I have to go to New York? I mean, you were hanging out in Boston. I mean, you'd been in comedy for how long?
Probably 3-4 years, and I came in the door from Atlantic City. I'd just been down there working. And as I came in the door, my answering machine was going off, and I could hear it was my mother in the hospital in New York, and my okay. dad had just had a heart attack and died. And he was about 50 years old, and it was obviously really pretty devastating.
Right, yeah, definitely.
And I'd been thinking about going. I'd gone to acting school in New York for a summer the year before, and I'd wanted to take a 2-year program of the Neighborhood Playhouse, which is where I took the summer program.
Okay.
And so I signed up. I got into that. I moved back to New York. I got a place in the city. I went to acting school. I was around my family and started doing stand-up. And I'd been doing the New York clubs for a while. Like I'd basically do like Worcester, Massachusetts, Friday, Saturday, 4 shows at a Chinese restaurant.
Okay.
And then I'd just get in my car at 1 a.m. and I'd drive to New York. And then I'd get up on a Monday morning or Sunday morning, whenever. Spent 2 or 3 nights hanging around the Comic Strip and the Comedy Cellar, just trying to get that 5-minute spot at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
And then I go back to Boston on the weekends and make money. And I'd been doing that for a year or two before
I
moved.
So it starts to tax you out a little bit.
Yeah, it was brutal. But it got me in at the clubs. And so when I got to New York, I was already passed in at a couple clubs and I was getting spots.
So did you start getting up a lot? I mean,
Yeah, I did. You know, I was lucky enough, Louis C.K. and Eddie Brill both really opened the doors for me at the clubs because I knew them because they would come up and work Boston. And so, you know, phone calls from those guys meant a lot to the club owners. And so I started getting, again, like late night spots. But then like Stand Up New York was a club that immediately Kerry Hoffman took me under his wing and okay. started giving me hosting spots a lot. And then you started working some of the rooms outside the city. And then also on the weekends, I was flying out and doing college shows. So the first couple of years in New York, I was doing a lot of colleges. I was doing spots in town. I was going to acting school and doing my SNL writing.
Okay, yeah, exactly. So you're in New York. So at what point do you start, do you get your, I mean, we talked about Idiot Savants, and back then, you know, it was a Comedy Central, but when was your first TV spot? Or also, when was you, I mean, you've done a lot of TV. I mean, but back then it was, I mean, there was tons of comedy TV.
Yeah.
What was your first spot? Do you remember?
My first spot ever was a show called Comedy on the Road with John Biner.
I remember that show.
It was on A&E, and they called me up. I sent a tape in to a guy who later became my manager, and he said, yeah, we like it. We're going to book you, and we're going to send you down to Acapulco, Mexico to tape because they sent people all over the
right.
country and, you know, Mexico, Canada. And I couldn't believe it. Not only was I getting on TV, but it was a big deal. I'd never been out of the country.
Right,
pretty
right.
much. And so I'm like, oh, this is great. And I'm waiting and the date's coming up. They told me October. And so I just assume I'm all set. And I call the booker like a month before. And I'm like, so I was still waiting to get the details. He's like, what are you talking about? I go, to do comedy on the road in Acapulco. He's like, I don't have you down for that. Like, he had no organizational skills,
okay.
no memory. And my heart sunk. I was
right.
like, I thought I was doing... And so he could hear the desperation in my voice.
Oh, yeah, because that's like a letdown.
Biggest thing that ever happened
yeah,
to me.
Yeah, it's TV. It's your first TV show.
So he goes, hold on, let me get back to you. And he calls me back a day later, and he's like, you're all set. I got you back on the show. I'm like, awesome. So how do I get to Mexico? And he's like, no, now you're doing it in West Orange, New Jersey.
Rascal? Yeah,
yeah,
you go from Acapulco to Rascals.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
But
that's
it was
beautiful.
Still my first TV spot, and it was me and Jim Brewer. And also Brewer,
okay.
you know, we were kids. Like, nobody knew who we were.
Yeah, I had met Jimmy at Ron Bennington's in Clearwater? I mean, I think it was down there because I was performing. And he was just a great guy.
Great guy. Always has been.
He was so animated.
Yeah.
Same thing. It was right before he got Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
But he was just a cool cat.
Yeah, he's always been a cool dude. Still is.
So you did that. And so that must have been, did people recognize you at all? Did you tell all your friends?
A little bit. Yeah, definitely. And then I did a Comedy Central, like, little 5-minute, one of those shows. And then I went up to the Montreal Comedy Festival
okay.
as a new face.
All right.
And now I'd been doing stand-up 7 or 8 years, and I've been pounding out sets. I mean, crazy. Like, I'm talking 350 nights of the year
right,
I was
right.
on stage. And so I go up to the Montreal Festival, and nobody knows me. I have no experience in the industry at all. Agents, managers, nobody knows who I am, which was kind of perfect because I go up and I'm a new face.
Yeah, and it takes the pressure off.
The pressure. I knew I could. I mean, I could do 10-minute sets in my sleep and can crush every time.
Right.
And so I go up. I have a great set, and people start talking. And so my next set, the room is more full. And there's like 7-8 comics on the show, but there's like a buzz that they're there to see me. I kill on that, and now I had one more set left, and the place is jammed with industry, and they're there to see me. And I get off stage, and there was a line of industry waiting to talk to me, handing me cards. Hi, I'm the head of Warner Brothers. We want to be in business with you. Hi, I'm from William Morris. We'd love to represent you. I left Montreal from having nothing to being managed by the best management company out there, the best agency out there. I had a development deal for a sitcom with Fox, and I booked a spot on Letterman all just in 5 days.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, it's so funny how, you had no buzz, and then just 3 shows, and oh my God, who's this guy? Who's this guy? So what was the whatever happened with the development deal? I mean, a lot of times they get development deals, but a lot of these things never pan out.
Oh, I've since had, no exaggeration, I've had 20 development deals between cable and network for sitcoms, game shows, sketch shows, and maybe one or two went, and the rest all failed, which is about right. That's about normal, 1 in 10.
Yeah, and it's weird now, too, because there's so much reality. And
yeah.
It's just like you can't get on something normal. I mean, my girlfriend's a big reality fan, and she's talking about Big Brother. I'm like, and she lives back east, so I'm going back this weekend to see her. And I'm like, how do you watch that? I'm like, that's not even TV.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, no. And I'm like, and then they have like Big Brother After Dark. And I'm like, it's unbelievable how it's
that's
like,
still on the air?
It's they have it 3 nights a week on CBS, and then every night on Showtime from midnight till 3, where they just have the people talking in the house.
Get so, out of here.
Yeah, isn't that sick?
And that's we're talking, what, 12 years?
Yeah, 12 years. I mean, that's just crazy. It's like people come up with good projects and that crap siphons through.
Yeah, yeah.
So you go, now did you move? Were you staying in New York, or when did you?
Well, I stayed in New York, and that's actually, I got that game show about 6 months after that, the MTV game show.
What was that like? I mean, did you audition against a lot of guys, or did they say, okay, this is a project for you, Greg?
No, I actually, they knew me, and they called my agent and said, we want him to host it. And the original host was Zach Galifianakis.
Oh, wow.
And then Zach couldn't read the cue cards. I think he's got dyslexia or something. And so he lost the job. And at the last minute, they were scrambling, and they knew me, and they said, do you want to do it? And I almost turned it down because I was like, I don't want to be a game show host.
Right, right.
And so I took the gig, and I actually loved it. And it was like the one gig in my life. I'm like, God, I wish that was the one that had lasted. It was really fun. And the guy who created it is one of my best friends to this day. And it was a good group of people that were on it, you know, good writers. A lot of them have gone on to be very successful. So that was great for me in terms of, like, club work. All of a sudden, I was, like, headlining A rooms.
Right,
and
right.
I was doing colleges at, like, way more money than I was making before. And it was a scary time, though, because it was some level of fame, and I wasn't ready for it, and I don't think I handled it very well.
How did it change? Just because people, when you went out, people recognized you?
Yeah.
Because people watched the show, and probably with MTV, it's probably a younger crowd, per se.
Yeah, that's why the colleges were especially good. But it was, I just think, and also the industry, how people started treating you. Everyone wants to sort of, like, you know, say nice things to you, and you start feeling like you can get whatever you want.
Right.
And you start thinking that, I don't know, like, I really copped a bad attitude because not to get, like, psychological, but I think that on some level maybe I didn't feel like I deserved it.
Okay.
And I felt like, you know, I was going to be discovered as being a phony, and, you know, and so I did myself a disservice, I think, in not enjoying that experience more, and maybe using it as a way to, you know, like, looking back, I love sitcoms.
Right.
I love game shows. I would love to be hosting a game show
now. Yeah, it's a fun job. My friend Jeff Martyr, I don't know if you know Jeff.
Sure.
Well, Jeff's a good friend of mine, and when he used to host a show, he said it was great. You go in, you tape like, Coop, you tape like 4 days, you know, one day, you do 4 shows, and then whatever. And
four, done, yeah, and four
done.
In a day.
And he's like, hey, and he goes, and it was, he loved it.
Yeah,
it
we would do We would do, like 16 shows in a week. And then you would be, you know, you do that for 3 or 4 weeks straight.
Right.
And then you had all that time afterwards to tour.
Yeah, and you're done. And
yeah. So that's great.
And we're going to take a break. Give me your website and your Twitter and all that.
Oh, it's fitzdog.com, F-I-T-Z-dog.com. And Twitter is at Greg Fitz Show.
Check him out. People also check me out at Cooper Talk on Twitter, at Cooper Talk on Facebook. Past episodes can be found on coopertalk.podbean.com. If you go to iTunes and type in one word, Cooper Talk, there's about 55 or 60 episodes. I'm going to put a bunch of back ones up. I haven't really been putting them up lately because I've been sick. But I'm going to put about 15 up this week. So, yeah, send me an email, Cooper at Indie100, INDIE100.com. We'll be back with Greg Fitzsimmons.
I guess the worst part of all this is that the fools who run this show broadcast this crap all over the world. Cooper Talk.
Would you like to find out how you can easily own gold and silver bullion? With oil prices and food costs skyrocketing, there's one sure way to hedge against inflation: owning precious metals. And we can show you how. Operators are standing by with your investor's kit on buying precious metals. Call 1-877-722-7032 to learn the secrets of protecting your net worth. Call now to learn how to hedge yourself with precious metals. We'll show you how to finance and own large amounts of precious metals with small amounts of money. This is not options or futures. We'll show you how to collateralize hundreds of thousands of dollars in precious metals with as little as a 25% investment. For an investor's kit with charts and graphs on the latest precious metals trends and opportunities, call 877-722-7032. That's 877-722-7032. To find out how you can own gold and silver and profit from the wild swings in today's economy. As with all speculative investments, purchasing precious metals involves a risk of loss and should be carefully evaluated prior to investing.
With supershopper.org, you can post your ad online in just 60 seconds. That's fast. That means that old junk sitting in your garage can be online in less time than it takes for you to stub your toe while looking for the light switch. List your electronics, furniture, automotive, garage sales, and more. If you can legally buy it and sell it, it's on. Supershopper.org. Job posting's just $25. Everything else, free. That means you can post your resume, get a job, find an apartment, furnish it, sell your car, buy an SUV, adopt a pet, find a house, get a mortgage, find a handyman, sell the house, buy a beach house, buy a surfboard. Supershopper.org. Now you get it.
Looking for great deals on apparel? Visit OnlineSalesMart.com. Currently, we have authentic Armani designer sunglasses at $100 or more off original price. Novelty neckties of all types for under $10. Necktie sets at discounted prices. And high-quality and genuine leather dress shoes, wallets, handbags, briefcases, and more for less. Visit www.OnlineSalesMart.com. All major credit cards are accepted and all orders are shipped on the double. Once again, that's OnlineSalesMart.com.
At Shakey's Pizza, don't cut back.
Cut loose with our all-you-can-eat Buncha Lunch. Now just $6.99.
Less belt tightening.
More belt loosening.
Shakey's all-you-can-eat Buncha Lunch. Now just $6.99.
Indie100.com.
Welcome back to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper. And remember, I'm only as hip as my guest. And today I'm only as hip as Greg Fitzsimmons. And I was going to say you're an Irish guy. So that's a good. Did you have a big Irish family?
Yeah, I'm 100% Irish, all Bronx Irish.
Okay.
And, you know, everyone's got seven kids. That seems to be the magic number.
Well, that's so funny. It's like Schubert was on 2 weeks ago, and he's talking because he's from Philly, and he had all the Irish brothers. And it's just like, you always think about it. Like, we had a, you always think about the Irish family. You just know the kids are raised in hell. You know, when they're in their house, they're good. But when they're out, it's like
you
they run
amok. Picture, yeah, jeans with the knees ripped out and bloody elbows and, you know, running home because the cops are chasing you. You know, and as the kids get, if you're the young kid, you're ignored because
right.
The parents are done.
Yeah. That's why I don't understand how parents, like, you know, I mean, I have one friend who has three kids, and he's like, you know, the difference between a second and a third is once you have the third, you can't come home and watch TV at night.
Yeah.
Because you just, cause I don't know how, I mean, I look at it, I don't know how people, I mean, I grew up with a family of three, and that's pretty normal in my neighborhood, but and there's bigger families and smaller families, but I don't know, I mean, that's why I don't see these, I don't know how people can raise seven kids anymore.
I got two, and I really feel like if you get the third, if you think about it, with two, you can go man-to-man defense.
Right.
Once you bring in three, They got a numerical advantage over you.
True. That's funny. True. So you have two kids?
I got two kids, boy and a girl.
Okay.
And they're, you know, they're at that sweet spot. They're 9 and 11. So
okay.
they're not assholes yet, and they still want to be around us, and you don't really have to do much for them. They're
right.
pretty, they're like turtles. They'll go get their own food and watch TV, and so it's like a great, great time to be around them.
That's cool. That's, yeah, it's just, that's what I say, the ages. It's like certain ages, and once I hit a certain age, and then now it's like my girlfriend's nephew, the kid just grew.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. The kid's like 11. He went from like, I mean, my girlfriend's 5'3". He went from a picture of her at Thanksgiving, he was like 5'3". Now he's like 5'10". It's like the guy, like, it's like, and they just go through school clothes because it's just this sudden upspring, man.
Well, puberty is right around the corner for my son.
Okay.
And he's projected, the doctor said he's going to be probably 6'3". I'm 5'8". And
wow.
And my son is also, he started doing Taekwondo at 4, and he just got his black belt. He's been going 3 days a week for 7 years. And so it's freaky to look at my kid and think, this guy's going to be towering over me.
Right, right.
And like, he's better, he's going to be better educated than me. He's better at, he's great at sports.
That's funny.
He's gorgeous.
See, that's great though.
It's great for him,
yeah.
Not for me.
Yeah, but if a father picks on you in the neighborhood, you're like, I'm going to get my son.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm like, no,
that's
I'm going
right.
to leave it at that.
That's right.
So, okay, so back to your, right. So you're in New York after Montreal blows up. Now you're getting gigs, you know, and then you're on Couch Potatoes. Now, when did you start getting writing? I mean, because you're writing, I mean, just names. I mean, I'm looking at, you know, you've written for a ton of shows. What was your first writing, like, your, not the SNL, but what was your first, like, writing job?
I started out, I got hired to do the audience warm-up at Politically Incorrect, Bill Maher's show on Comedy Central.
Now, that was out here, right?
That was in New York originally.
Okay.
And so I used to go in and do the warm-up for the show, and then Bill Maher liked my material, so I got hired as a writer.
Did a guy named Bill Kelly write on that?
Yes.
Now, is he still around? Because
he still writes on the show.
Okay, because
in and out. I mean, the thing is about the roster of writers over there is they kind of, there's an open door. You know, guys like Hayes Jackson and Eric Weinberg, they're they can go work on a sitcom and then come back and work on Bill's show.
No, because Bill Kelly was a comic from Philly who showed up out of nowhere, and his act was, you could tell it was one of those, I mean, people write in different ways. Like me, when I write my comedy, something will come to my mind when I'm walking down the street. But some people sit there and they look at the paper and they do for their act. Like, okay, they think of a word and they write that way. And that's like Bill's act. Bill's was always very, very smart jokes, very worded out. Like you could tell he was sitting there and he had an idea and he concentrate until he got it right. And he just blew up. I mean, he was in Philly for a little bit. And then Clay Heery, who was like the owner of the club back then, liked him. And the next thing you know, Bill was out like writing for Politically Incorrect.
He's really known as being a phenomenal writer.
Yeah,
you know,
he has like that insight.
Yeah, he's just really, really gifted. And, you know, there was all those guys. I mean, the guys that Bill had writing for him back then when I was writing for him, they're all still with him. Like all of them. And that's pretty amazing.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about 15 years. That doesn't happen in TV.
And that was your first writing gig?
Yeah, so I was on that, and then...
did people help you out? Did people mentor you a little bit?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Hayes Jackson in particular and Eric Weinberg really just pulled for me because I was not necessarily up to speed politically at that time. I think I was distracted with doing stand-up. As a matter of fact, I left the show because I got, I forget, something, maybe it was the game show, something happened where I left, maybe got laid off at the same time. It was a parting of ways. And but I know when I was there, I needed help, and those guys really gave it to me.
Okay. So you go from there, and then what's your next writing gig?
Oh, God. Well, I had development deals where I was writing sitcom scripts for myself, and I did that. And then you know, I can't remember. I picked up little writing jobs here and there, but the first like kind of more official writing job was my son was about one, and I'd been on the road and missed a lot of the first year of his life.
Okay.
Because I was scrambling. I was like, you know, I was making good money, but I felt like a kid. I need a lot of money.
Right. Exactly.
So I just booked myself on the road for like 35, 40 weeks. And then I said, I got to get the hell off the road. So I called Louis C.K. and I was like, hey, man, can you help me get a writing job on a TV show? So he calls me back a day later.
Okay.
And he was writing on a show at that point called Cedric the Entertainer Presents.
Okay.
And he said, come on in and meet Cedric. They're looking for a writer who can write the monologue with him. And I go, monologue? I said, because it was a sketch show. I said, you know, he's a black guy from St. Louis.
Right.
I don't know what I, how do I help him? So I come in, and I guess he'd watch my stand-up and read probably those Saturday Night Live jokes I'd written before. And I sat down with him, and we riffed, and I got hired on the spot. So I spent the season, was it two seasons or one season? But so I would sit with Cedric, and I'd write the monologue.
Now, that was in New York?
No, that was in L.A.
So how did, but you were living in New York at the time? Or?
No. I had moved to L.A. because I had
development deals.
Yeah, I had development deals, and I had meetings and auditions, and it seemed like I was flying out to L.A. a lot. So I moved, me and my fiance moved out to L.A.
How'd you take the change? I mean, just because I'm from the East Coast, and it just, I mean, when you move, especially you went from Boston to New York.
No, New York.
New York to Boston.
Yeah, Boston, New York, and then New York to L.A., yeah.
It's just such a different lifestyle out here.
Yeah, it is. And we luckily moved to the West Side, which was, it's a nice place to live in L.A.
Right.
You could go to the beach, and it just seems cooler. And it was like, you know, we got married in that first year, and then we had a baby the following year. So I think it was a lot of my focus was on my wife and my family. And I had a lot of my friends had moved out here from New York. And so we would have, like, every Sunday we had a waffle breakfast and watch football. And
see, that's cool.
Yeah, so I had this constant connection with my good friends. And it was kind of cool to be going in on – I auditioned for a lot of sitcoms.
Okay.
I mean, I think I probably went on 100, 150 sitcom auditions.
What was your role? Like, for me, it's so funny. Sometimes I get the things from my agent. It's like you know, sort of off creepy guy, whatever. And you go in and you look at yourself and like, I'm like, okay, I'm not that creepy. There's some really creepy looking bastards. And I get some of that sometimes.
Yeah.
Or I get a father, a professional. What were some of the auditions?
Well, back then I was probably 30.
Okay.
And so I was going in as the young dad.
Okay.
And I looked young for my age. I still had hair. And no, they were good roles. I mean, like, I can name, shows like Friends. And, you know, I went in on all the big shows.
Okay.
And I never got a single job.
Isn't that weird?
And I, again, went to acting school for 2 years in New York. And, you know, in acting classes, I was really stood out. My teachers were like, but I never learned how to audition.
Okay.
And it's like, you know, the guy who can hit on a girl, it doesn't necessarily mean he's better in a relationship.
Right.
But he gets laid more.
Exactly.
And so I think I never really got past whatever insecurities I had with going in on an audition, feeling like I'm a stand-up comic, I'm not an actor. And I'm convinced that if I'd ever really gotten a job, I think I could have really done a decent job.
Right.
But I never really got that chance. Later on, I did an episode of CSI.
That's cool.
Of course, a drama after all that.
Who'd you play?
I played a stand-up comic.
Okay.
Who is threatened by a heckler, and then later on, I'm walking through a parking lot, and you think I'm going to get killed, and then I'm talking to the cops later about the whole thing. It was really a nice role, but the point being, I think if I could go back, I really thought I was going to get something, but I didn't really want it. Like, I really was, that's a big part of it too, is like, I never loved sitcoms, and I don't think I ever was passionate about being on one.
Right.
So I think my energy might have been better spent just on stand-up and writing, which I was starting to do and really enjoyed.
So you're writing for Cedric. And then okay, where do you go from there? Because, I mean, your list, you have Ellen, you have The Man Show, you have, you know, The Gong Show. I mean, you have a ton of stuff. What, where did you go after Cedric? How long was Cedric? 1 year or 2 years?
Yeah, it was a year. And then I went from there to Louis had a pilot on ABC. So I went off and worked on that. And then I went to The Man Show. And I went from The Man Show ending on a Friday to starting on the Ellen DeGeneres Show on a Monday. You talk about the hardest turn in comedy writing ever.
God.
And then I was at Ellen for like 2 years.
So what is it like in your, like the Cedric Show, did you know it was getting canceled or did you know it was going off or just?
It was the highest rated black show on television.
And then what, did they just?
Nobody cares about black viewers.
So they pulled the plug. Now,
pulled the plug.
What's that like? I guess you didn't see it coming.
No way.
So how did they do it? How did they tell you you're fired?
Well, they don't tell you because the season ends. Oh, no, I'm sorry. We did find out at the very end that it wasn't coming back. The executive producers came in the room, John Bowman and Matt Wickline, and we're all sitting there. And, I mean, all-star cast of writers, you know, Jerry Minor.
Right.
And Chuck Deasy, Foshizi. Just a bunch of really talented people that have gone on to big things and said, it's over, it's over. And we just all looked at them like, this must be a joke. And it was we had so much fun. It was a really cool environment to work in. And the show was really good. But that was kind of crushing. It's always crushing until you've done it for enough years that you, first of all, know that when they say it's picked up, you don't believe it until you've got a check in your hand.
So, okay, so you go to the Man Show, which, I mean, what was that process? I mean, that's what's so funny, because Carolla went through the whole thing with the females aren't funny and all that. And...
Well, I went when it was Rogan and Stanhope.
Oh, okay. So, okay, that was towards the end?
That was the final season. They switched over to those guys. And it was kind of tough. Joe was working nonstop on Fear Factor and another show. And it was kind of like we were cursed because it wasn't Adam and...
Right.
I mean, Jimmy and Adam together were phenomenal, and it was their show. And I think it was a little bit of a desperate move by Comedy Central. And I came on, and I was a consulting producer, which is a title that I take on a lot of shows, like the one I'm doing right now, where I go in 2 or 3 days a week, and I punch up. But I don't have to go in every day, which is kind of a sweet gig. And so that was kind of, you know, long hours, and the finished product wasn't as good as you would hope it would be.
Okay.
And then I went from there to Ellen, which was the big time. I mean, this was syndicated TV with a lot of money behind it and high exposure. And that was a daily show. Every day you showed up to work with a blank page.
Okay.
And at 5 o'clock the show was happening, and people don't realize how written a variety show is. I mean, from...
Explain that.
Well, I mean, from the second that she walks out, or he walks out, whatever the show is, that monologue is written word for word, is beaded out, and it's a lot of words to write. And then you go into the desk pieces where they sit down, and everything looks conversational and off the top of the head, but it's all written. Then you have a guest come out. That's written, the questions. Then you get to maybe a game, an audience game, or maybe you've done a remote piece where you've got to write it, go out and shoot it, and edit it. This is all for one show, and so you're scrambling to pull all this together.
Now, what was your? I mean, were you just writing monologue, or were you doing everything? Or could
no,
you,
it's kind of most people were utility. You know, you did different things. Okay. I think monologue was probably my strength. That's always been kind of what I did. I did it for Cedric. I did it on The Man Show. I pretty much have focused on monologues.
And from being a stand-up, I mean, you have insight of, you know what it is. I mean, I've heard, like, some of these shows, they don't have many comics writing on a lot of them. I mean, some of the, you know, and it's like a comic has the best insight for a monologue.
It depends. I mean, comics sometimes can only write for themselves. But I was really focused always on, you know, what works for them. And again, I got a lot of good advice from Louis. And he said, you know, don't ever get married to a joke. If you pitch it and it doesn't go, don't ever re-pitch it. Let it go. Don't do stuff that would just make you laugh. You're writing for somebody else. You have to get into their head. And so to me, that's part of the fun. That's part of the creativity, is how do I go from writing for a stoned man show host to, you know, a lesbian who is upbeat and funny in a totally different way.
So, okay, so how long are you with Ellen?
2 years, and then that didn't I wasn't happy by the end of that. It was just got too corporate, and it just wasn't fun anymore. So I ended up leaving there, and then I wrote on a show with Patrice O'Neill for Comedy Central for a bit, and then I got a sitcom writing job.
What sitcom?
It never aired. We wrote like 8 episodes.
Isn't that weird?
I don't get sets.
It's like they do, and it's like sometimes you see, like, they'll cancel a sitcom after like 2 episodes, but they already have 8 shot. It's like, you know, you're not gonna get. I mean, it's not. You're not gonna get ratings overnight on another sitcom.
Yeah,
you already made the product. Just show it.
Yeah. It's you know, cost them $5 million probably to do what they did, and then they never used a second of it. And
why
you realize,
not? I mean, just
well, I guess the if you, I guess whatever they make for a sitcom in a half an hour, I guess dwarfs that $5 million if they don't think it's going to be a hit. So they cut their losses, and this was with Alyssa Milano and Bo Bridges. This was, you know, a good cast.
Yeah. It's not like schmucks, you know. It's a
yeah.
Good...
So then I got pulled on. Then Louis C.K. had a show on HBO called Lucky Louie.
Okay.
And then he asked me to write on that. So I was there for a full year.
Now, was that shot in New York or here?
No, that was in L.A.
Oh, it was shot. Okay.
Yeah. And that was phenomenal. That was another great team of people.
Well, Norton was involved with that.
Yeah, right? Norton was on the show. Okay. Laura Keitlinger and a lot of talent. Then Nick DiPaolo and Todd Barry. And a lot of great comics came on. And it ultimately wasn't what Louis wanted to do. It was, I think he felt very confined by the sitcom structure, that sitcom structure. And so then I left there, and I've worked on so many shows. It all becomes a blur after a while.
It's so funny. But the good thing is you're constantly working.
Yeah, and then in between it and during it, I'm out doing stand-up. I mean, I would go on the road on weekends. I'd write all week on a show, and then I'd fly out after work somewhere. Tell jokes all weekend.
At least now it's easier because your kids are growing up. It's like you've got past that point where it's like it must be take a little pressure off you now. Like you're not missing their little formative.
No, I really make my own schedule a lot more now. Before I was reacting, I was taking everything that was thrown at me. And now it's like I do a radio show on Howard Stern's channel for like the last 5-6 years on Monday nights. And then I do a podcast twice a week. And that stuff all keeps me home. I can do that from right. wherever, whenever, the podcast, whenever. And then, the road work I do is like I've got that dozen clubs that I love that right. I go in. I never work Sunday nights. And I have certain things about my schedule that I do. I don't work more than 2 weekends in a row ever. And, you know, and I'm just around more. And when I'm home, I'm there. And then when I write on shows, I don't really go on the road as much as I used
right.
to. So there's much more balance. And I've gotten to the point, luckily, where I can continue to work in both areas. So I don't have to take a writing gig. I don't want to because I can just say, that's fine. I'll just call my agent and book some road work.
Right.
And then if I don't want to work a certain club, I don't have to work that club because I don't have to fill a calendar for a whole year. I'm
right.
only working, you know, if it's 20 weekends a year, then I can easily fill that with the clubs that I really like.
We're going to take a quick break. Once again, give your info for the people.
It's GregFitzsimmons.com or FitzDog.com and follow me at GregFitzShow.
Check out his website. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about your book when we get back. I saw you have a book that just came out.
It's unbelievable.
We're going to talk about that. Remember, hit me up at CooperTalk on Twitter. Get me some more followers. I have like 13,900. Get me up to 15,000. That would make my day. I don't ask for much. 15,000 would make me happy. That's
ask
fine.
Your friends to follow.
And my friends don't follow.
No, I'm saying you ask your friends exactly. to ask their friends to
That's
follow.
That's what I should do. I'm not good at the Facebook. Somehow I just got these followers, but I'm not good at Facebook. I don't know
you
the
gotta
whole patch
You got to send
thing.
A lot of Twitter stuff. You got to send out.
Twitter,
if you
yes.
want to really grow, here, let me give you two pieces of advice before commercial. Number one, yeah, hashtag stuff a lot and also include at with other people that you like. You know, that you dig and you read their tweets, include them in some of their tweets, in your tweets, and they may retweet it to their followers.
That's cool.
Yeah, those two things will help a lot.
There you go. That's and for anyone else out there who's tweeting, you got insight from a professional company.
I've got 40,000, so I'm not really a king. I'm
yeah, but
really
40,000. I mean, I'm happy with 13,000.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's better than having like 100.
Yeah.
You know? But it's like, but you see some people, you go, holy crap.
I know.
It's like a million. And it's like, they can't respond to everything because it's like they must get so many ats their way. And you know, I can't
yeah.
even conceive a million. I mean, it's like
it's pretty crazy.
It's insane.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll be back with Craig Fitzsimmons. I'm Steve Cooper. Hit me up an email at Cooper at Indie100, INDIE100.com. And go to CooperTalk.podbean.com. We'll be back talking about Greg's book. As soon as my commercial, this always happens.
It's like flying high-priced hookers to your hotel room from New York.
Taking it slowly into my hot, wet...
Okay, maybe not. But it is cheaper. Cooper Talk.
Cooper Talk.
Looking for great deals on apparel? Visit OnlineSalesMart.com. Currently, we have authentic Armani designer sunglasses at $100 or more off original price. Novelty neckties of all types for under $10. Necktie sets at discounted prices. And high-quality and genuine leather dress shoes, wallets, handbags, briefcases, and more for less. Visit www.OnlineSalesMart.com. All major credit cards are accepted and all orders are shipped on the double. Once again, that's OnlineSalesMart.com.
Remember abundance. At Shakey's Pizza, don't cut back.
Cut loose with our all-you-can-eat bunch of lunch. Now just $6.99.
Less belt tightening.
More belt loosening.
Shakey's all-you-can-eat bunch of lunch. Now just $6.99.
With supershopper.org, you can post your ad online in just 60 seconds. That's fast. That means that old junk sitting in your garage can be online in less time than it takes for you to stub your toe while looking for the light switch. List your electronics, furniture, automotive, garage sales, and more. If you can legally buy it and sell it, it's on. Supershopper.org. Job postings just $25. Everything else, free. That means you can post your resume, get a job, find an apartment, furnish it, sell your car, buy an SUV, adopt a pet, find a house, get a mortgage, find a handyman, sell the house, buy a beach house, buy a surfboard. Supershopper.org. Now you get it.
Would you like to find out how you can easily own gold and silver bullion? With oil prices and food costs skyrocketing, there's one sure way to hedge against inflation: owning precious metals. And we can show you how. Operators are standing by with your investor's kit on buying precious metals. Call 1-877-722-7032 to learn the secrets of protecting your net worth. Call now to learn how to hedge yourself with precious metals. We'll show you how to finance and own large amounts of precious metals with small amounts of money. This is not options or futures. We'll show you how to collateralize hundreds of thousands of dollars in precious metals with as little as a 25% investment. For an investor's kit with charts and graphs on the latest precious metals trends and opportunities, call 877-722-7032. That's 877-722-7032. To find out how you can own gold and silver and profit from the wild swings in today's economy. As with all speculative investments, purchasing precious metals involves a risk of loss and should be carefully evaluated prior to investing.
Indy100.com.
Welcome back to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper. And remember, I'm only as hip as my guests. And I'm at the GregFitzsimmons.com right now. And it's a very good website. And it's his book. There's his audio book. It's now on the book. It's on Amazon. It's called Dear Mr. Mrs. Fitzsimmons. Now, what is the book about, Greg?
Well, I've always had problems with authority my whole life, and so I found out later in life, I found a box in the basement in the Bronx of my aunt's house of letters my mother had saved my whole life, disciplinary reports, behavior reports, police reports. Every time I was in trouble, she saved it, because my parents, I think maybe being Irish, thought it was funny. And they used to read the letters at the dinner table and laugh, and so we were kind of almost encouraged to behave that way. And so the book actually has those letters in it. And then I talked about each section of my life that the letter took place in, the stories. I saved letters from my adulthood from clubs that have written letters to my agent. And it was one from a high school principal. They had asked me to do a prom show in Iowa, and they wrote a letter to my agent that I'd corrupted the morality of the entire town.
That's funny. Well, it's like, but yeah, that's all that cracks me up is the prom. Like, why are you going to bring a comic to the prom? It's like when in Dangerfield, they said the prom show. It's like the whole prom would show up, and it's like, and I heard Rodney, man, that back when he was like towards the end, just, you know, was getting hammered, and he would just go in and just like pour the poor kids in there, because he'd be like, yeah, I like to do this to you, you know.
And the gig was, if you got hired to do the prom nights, and it was all spring, if you were one of the lucky comics, they basically would book four comics, and the show would start at 8 o'clock, and it would go until 2:30 in the morning. And you would – the show never – it wasn't like there was an early show, late show. The show started at 8 and ended at 2:30, and the four comics went in rotation. They'd each do 20, 25 minutes, and then proms would come in, leave, come in, leave, and like a revolving door. And so you just waited your turn to go back up again. And they paid you, which you didn't, you, as you know, in New York City, you don't get paid much. You get $20 a set, maybe 30, 40. And you got paid like $500 for the night.
Right.
But you were like one of those dancers where you get your card punched.
That's so funny.
Yeah. So anyway, so the book basically tracks this problem with authority, but I ended up going way deeper than I planned on, because I started to connect the dots a little bit of why was I like this. And it led back to, I talked earlier about my father was a big tough guy, and you know, there was physical abuse, and I had a real chip on my shoulder, and so he represented the first authority figure. So the book ultimately became about my relationship to my dad.
Okay.
And how, you know, how close we were, but he died young, and how I dealt with that, and how it changed me.
That must have been, I mean, you know, you think about it, because I'm 47, And I just decided I went to my heart thing, which is, you know, it's scary. I mean, especially when you
can't imagine.
We, you know, we think we're invincible. And mine was, I mean, they call it congestive heart failure. They call it that because it's not as bad as it sounds. But if they called it something stupid, you wouldn't take it serious.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, it's like I'm on medication. I've lost weight. And people are like, you know, what is he, AIDS? You know, it's like, what, you know, whatever. And you think we get to a point, especially doing comedy and, you know, we're just doing anything in the entertainment, you sort of have that invincible feel, you know, and from years on the road, you know, the drinking, the eating crappy, you know, doing whatever you did, you know, it all catches up to us. And it's just when it hit me, it was like, damn, it was like, I'm not even 50. And I'm on the floor with all like these old people. It's like it's St. Joseph's right here in Burbank. And it's just, it must be weird. But for you, it must have been hard. I mean, how old were you when your father passed? You were
24.
So that must be hard because, like me, my dad's 87, but he's been through a stroke. He's been, you know, through that stuff. And you always look at your father as this strong figure. And now when I see him now, he's like this old man. And even though he's 87, I understand he's lived through all this stuff. You look at it, and because we do, like you said, we have our first experience of knowing a male is our father. And my father was very quiet, but silent, but don't mess with them tight. It was small, but whatever you say, you didn't have to say where we knew. We don't want to get grounded. But for you, it must have been really affected you because, I mean, especially you're at that age, it probably came out of nowhere.
Yeah, it did. I mean, he had, he smoked 3.5 packs a day and he drank and red meat and mostly, and I really believe stress is more of a factor in heart attacks and cancer and most diseases than anything else. And I think he lived with a lot of anxiety and stress in his life. He'd had a very tough childhood.
Okay.
And he was he never really dealt with a lot of stuff. And he pushed himself hard. And that's something I'm very aware of when I talk before about having some balance in my life. I mean, I'm 46, and I have this number in my head that he was 51 when he died, that I'm going to die at 51.
Right.
You know?
That's the thing. That's what's weird for me, though, because I have this thing. I mean, my aunt was in and out of, she just died at 90, and she smoked and drank.
Yeah.
In and out of the hospital. And we always say that. We always go, we have the number. I'm like, for me, when it happened, I'm like, yeah, you know, and heart disease runs in my family. You don't think about it, because my dad's older at 87, but for you, it must be a weird thing thinking 51, that's not too far off for you.
Yeah, it causes me a lot of stress. You know, I got two kids, and I think about, I have a lot of life insurance, and I've saved a lot of money, and paid off my house for the most part because I own my cars outright. When I die, I don't want my wife, and my dad did the same thing. When he died, I couldn't believe it. I was in Boston and I thought, I got to start earning a lot of money. I got to take care of my mom because my dad lived big. You know, he had the Lincoln Town Car and he belonged to a golf club and he ate out 5 nights a week at the best restaurants in New York, generous vacations, the whole thing. And I figured they got nothing. But he knew, you know, his parents both died when he was young. I never met my grandparents. And he knew because he had tons of life insurance. He had this whole stock portfolio put aside and all kinds of investments. And my mom was set for life.
Right.
I couldn't believe it. And so I'm the same way. If I die today, my wife will be set for life.
Now, are you preventative about it? Do you eat differently?
I eat really well. I exercise. I do yoga. I try to keep that stress down.
Okay, I mean,
I go to therapy.
See, the problem is your stress is you're stressing about that.
The stress.
So, okay, so that's in your book. Now, was it cathartic writing about, you know, when you got to the inner things, as you said in the book, you delved a little deeper, or was that a little scary that you had to share that with people? I mean, where was that like? Because you know you have a big following, so a lot of people are going to read this. It's not like you're just writing a humorous book. Yeah, I mean, there's going to be humor, but you're writing about stuff. Where your issues came from. Were you a little worried about bearing that, or how people would take that, or I mean.
Yeah, I think it was the hardest thing. Really, was as you said, like going there. The catharsis was mixed with deep depression. You know, I was reliving parts of my childhood that I didn't really think much about before. And looking at my life with the perspective and the distance of age and going, wow, this poor kid, you know? And it made me, I don't know, I guess it made me really wonder how I made it.
Right.
You know? And it made me think about my kids and what kind of a father I was going to be, and the guilt of not wanting to be like my dad. And I think it was in the long run healthy, but I almost had a nervous breakdown. I mean, I started going to therapy. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I went on a lot of medications to get through it. I mean, I went on all kinds of drugs.
Now, did that affect, a lot of times people say the medications affect your creativity. Did that affect you at all? Or
I also started abusing Vicodin while I was writing it for a while, because it was much easier to write with the pain. I had to deal with the pain of writing it. And it when you take Vicodin and you write, you're fearless. I'm not advocating for Vicodin, because when I went off it was one of the darkest couple of days of my life. I mean, it was brutal. But it was something I felt like I needed, and the drugs I took, I think they helped, but they do cut you off a bit from your clarity. It takes your edge off a little bit, but I needed that.
Right.
You know.
So how's the book doing? Is it selling? Is it?
Oh, it's done great. Yeah, the hardcover did great, and then I put the audio book out back in November.
Now,
and that's been even better than the book.
Have you gotten emails from people who have read it and they've associated with it? I mean, like,
oh yeah,
like
I saved every single one of them. See? I've got a folder on my computer of every note anyone's written me about the book. Every one of them touches me.
Now, do you try to respond to them?
All of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it must give you a good feeling that not only is it selling, not only did you get this off your chest, but that people are actually reading it and they're appreciating it. I mean, it's like, because so many comics books are just, you know, the comedy book. You know,
yeah,
I mean?
Series of their, you know, rants or their act and book form.
It must make it a good feeling. I mean, you know.
Well, yeah, and I was an English major. You know, I really wanted to be a writer as a kid, and I had that on my list of, I hate the term bucket list, but on my list of things I wanted to accomplish in my life, writing a book was absolutely a big thing. And writing a real book, not, you know, writing either a novel or a true memoir that was honest and had a narrative to it and a structure. And it's what kept me from quitting on it, and that and the fact that it paid me a bunch of money up front to write it.
So there you go. You're like, I have to get it done.
I got to get it done with the deadline. And I stuck to my deadline. I found out later you don't have to, which I wish I knew that now. I would have loved to spend 3 more months on it. I think it's something that was hard on my family. My mother handled it extremely well, considering some of the stuff that was in there I know made her uncomfortable. And I love her for it. You know, the support she gave me, unconditionally supportive about the book. And it was as tough as it was, yeah, it was something that was important in my life. And I'll always have that. And the hard thing is now my kids.
Right.
I mean, there is shit in this book I really don't want my kids knowing about me. There's some hardcore stuff in there.
Okay.
And so I've really got to figure out at what age I'm going to let them read it and how I'm going to handle saying, now, I did this, but you should not do this.
Right. Well, I think also, I mean, I think if and one thing about it is if they read it, I'm sure you're a completely different father.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one thing. And that's what cracks me up. I mean, I had a great father, but it's like there's certain things that irritate me. I see them in me now. It's like he would get pissed at something. And I'd be like, it'd be so stupid. Like, I get very my girlfriend says, you get frustrated over nothing sometimes. I'm like, yeah, because she goes, you know, calm down. You know, that doesn't – if the cable goes out for 1 second, and it's just that thing you get from your dad.
Yeah.
But at least your kids, you know, if your kids do read it, they'll go, wow, at least dad changed. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, it would be, of course.
Yes, I think that's the lesson is, you know, kids – you know, I'm not happy. I'm not proud of this stuff. I wrote it down because it's a story.
Right.
But I'm not the thing I want you to take from this is that you can change, and that, you know, you always need to have the courage to try to make your life better than it was and deal with whatever, you know, life hands you.
Okay, so we got to wrap up. So they can get it on...
If you go to fitzdog.com, you can get it. Go to audible.com or iTunes. You can download the book there.
So they can get it on the Kindle and stuff like
that. Yeah, Kindle. And if you go to iTunes, if you get it on the Mac rather than the Kindle, there's videos that launch. I have, like, everybody from, you know, Sarah Silverman and Zach Galifianakis and Bob Saget all reading from the book.
You just said read these and they read each
chapter? They just read the letters. The letters themselves, I had them read them as if they were the teacher or the principal writing the note.
Cool.
Yeah, and then, so you can get anywhere, and that's all I try to sell.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for coming on. Once again, give you your info.
Fitzdog Radio is the podcast, and you can get that on iTunes. And then Fitzdog.com is where you can get the book, the website, and at Greg Fitz Show is the Twitter.
So check them out, please. Get the book. I'm at CooperTalk, CooperTalk.podbean.com. I have some great guests coming up in the next few weeks, and if you know one you want to hear, I'll try to get them. Send me a message at cooperindy100.com. Remember, I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests. This has been Cooper Talk. You guys have a wonderful weekend.